So I did this research paper called Transcending Health Values, an Emerging Concept, and had it published. And I thought that it would be interesting for us this weekend, and I hope that you find this as exciting as I do. I kind of nerd out a little bit on research right now. You may not, but I really enjoy reading research articles and find myself looking up different things. Anyway, so yeah, I do have a master's degree in nursing education, and I'm also the FCN. Did anybody wonder what that acronym was? Yeah, that's a new one. So I am a faith community nurse. So I am doing basically what we do in our churches. Okay, so this is a certification called faith community nursing. It used to be called parish nursing years ago, if you've ever heard of that. But there's this, you know, how they like to rename everything to make it more whatever. Anyway, I took this certification because it's what we already do in our churches. You know, somebody comes to you and says, hey, this hurts. What do I need to do? And so you say, well, don't do that. You know, go, you need to go here, take this, do whatever, and then they do whatever they want to, right? And so I was like, well, this is going to help me with my research because my research interest is basically perceptions of healthcare amongst conservative Anabaptists, which I find really, really intriguing. Healthcare, you know, how conservative Anabaptists describe healthcare. Anyway, so that's what FCN is. It's a faith community nurse. Basically, it's what we all do. I just, you know, took a class and got a certification. So, you know, people in healthcare like to use acronyms after their names, right? Go all the way off their badge. Okay, so how did this start? How did this topic, transcending health values, start? And why do I want to do research on how conservative Anabaptists describe health-seeking behaviors? So that is a very nice picture of me and my wife. Look how young and carefree we look. You know, in that picture, the world is our oyster. We can do whatever we want to do. We don't have the bags under our eyes, and we look happy and in love. Anyway, so this is how it started. I met my wife, Amy. So I grew up, I do not have conservative Anabaptist background. Obviously, you can tell that from my last name, Huddle. You know, I like going into conservative Anabaptist circles, and people ask me, who are you? Or if they hear me speak Pennsylvania Dutch, they're like, wer bist du? And I'm like, Matthew Huddle. And they're like, Huddle, Huddle, Huddle. Because they love me like, oh, you know, I'm a Yoder from Holmes County, or I'm a Yoder from here or there. They love to play the Mennonite game, so I love that look that comes across their eyes. Anyway, so my wife and I met. I grew up in a small community in West Virginia. We lovingly refer to it as the Holler because it is the Holler. If you've ever been to Blackwater Falls, Canaan Valley, West Virginia, that's where I grew up. I started working at a small rural hospital in Garrett County, Maryland, and had a bunch of failed relationships because I wanted a good Christian woman, and I wanted someone that, you know, that shared some same values as me. And as I was getting meds in the med room one day, one of our ER techs said, hey, Matthew, there's this girl in my nursing class you should meet. And so I said, okay, well, I'll check on the Facebook and I'll stalk her and see what she looks like. And I stalked her and I looked at that pretty redhead and I thought, she's got to be mine. What I didn't know was Kevin Koblentz and I had worked in the same hospital. I didn't know that they were cousins to Amy. And so Kevin invited me to a singing at our church, and Amy happened to be there. And you know, love at first sight, I don't know, but it was pretty close to them. Anyway, so I went to ask Amy, you know, maybe we should get to know each other better. And she said, you need to ask my dad. And I thought, I need to ask your dad to go on a date? Like, this was not, you know, part of what I grew up with. And I was like, okay. And I hate the telephone. And so I called, and you know, I called him, like, I knew he was a dairy farmer. She told me about when he would be out of the barn. And so I called him and I was like, you know, Mr. Beachy, is there any way that I could get to know Amy better? And he said, well, you need to get to know me better. Meet me for dinner. And so So I went to dinner with him. We met at a little restaurant, and we talked, and he had little flashcards in his pockets and asked me what I thought about the veiling, about non-resistance, and about modest dress and all of these things. And I answered. You know, I grew up in a little United Methodist country church, and I was pretty active there. Anyway, he said, well, he'll let me know. So that was in March, I think. March came and went. May came and went. June came and went. No, June came. And finally, he called me, and he said, Matthew, I can't let you date my daughter. So Amy started working at the hospital, and I would find every excuse I could to go up and see her. So I remember going, because, you know, I was friends with most of the people at the hospital, so I would get like a Coudet catheter and run upstairs and say to the nursing supervisor, just pretend like you need this so I can see Amy. And yeah, that's a real love story, isn't it? And I would leave little Hershey kisses on her med cart, and I knew this was not a good thing. I probably shouldn't be doing this because my wife is very respectful. And so we truly did agree to, honor her dad's wishes. But there was just something about her that I couldn't let go. And so I finally caught her in the parking lot one day. And I said, I'm going to call your dad again. But I want you to tell him that I'm going to call. So I called him again. And I said, Mr. Beachy, is there anything that I can say or do to convince you to let me to get to know Amy better? He said, meet us for dinner. And so I drove to another restaurant and met Mr. and Mrs. Beachy this time. And they sat across the table. He got out his index cards and started quizzing me again. And I really think Mrs. Beachy, my mother-in-law, I really think she was the saving grace there. And she, you know, anyway, put in a good word for me. The next day, Mr. Beachy called, Phil Beachy's his name, from Salisbury, Pennsylvania, called me and said, yes, I could date Amy. Immediately got off the phone, called her, and said, let's go on a date tomorrow night. And so we did, and the rest is history. So when we first got married, we weren't sure what we were going to do. Were we going to attend the little community church that I grew up in, or were we going to go to Mountain View, where our home church is now? As I started going there, I really loved the involvement of men in the church. I really loved hearing men sing, because in my church growing up, men really didn't sing. They just kind of stand there and hold the hymnal and just stand there. There was other things. I was talking to someone earlier this evening, and you know, I had my heart was towards non-resistance in a church that was very patriotic, and I just thought that I was being, just being a wuss. I don't know what other the better word is, coward. Why wouldn't I go off to war and things like that? Why did I feel this? I felt like, you know, on my own, and I realized it's a real, like, non-resistance is a real thing that the church, some churches teach. And so anyway, we decided to go there. And so I have found it so interesting coming from where I come from and joining our church, how conservative Anabaptists look on healthcare. And there are the crunchiest people, crunchiest, like we would have said, like the granola people, like herbs and roots and stuff. All, you know, in our congregations, and you know, won't take this or that. And I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying we have that to we have someone over here that will go to the doctor every time they sneeze. We have this wide gamut. But in the middle, there's this middle thing. And it's just very interesting to me. And find out reasons why. Anyway, so when I started this PhD journey, I thought, what do I want to study? I want to study how conservative Anabaptists describe health-seeking behaviors. Okay, so I started into this, and it was kind of bizarre because everywhere I go, people are like, conservative, what? Anti-Baptist? Or like, what do you want to agree? And, you know, the whole hot topics now, it's like everyone in my cohort is like, they're studying like opioid dependencies, LGBTQ, transgender studies. There's a forensic nurse that is studying rape culture and things like that. And here I am over here wanting to study this conservative group of people. And so it's not necessarily the hot topic that everyone is studying and everybody wants to publish, but every time that I talk about what I want to do, people start to perk up. Anyway, so that's the story of how it started. So this concept that I developed, I have a couple definitions up here because it's the school teacher in me, because I want to make sure that you know what we're talking about. So a concept, which is what I'm doing, transcending health values, is an initial understanding of a phenomenon. And the phenomenon that I want to study, why is conservative Anabaptists delay in seeking health care? Why? So why do conservative Anabaptists come to the doctor or the hospital when they're almost dead? We treat them and it was the hospital that killed them. And that's not general. So, you know, and I think that you and I, we understand that there's a lot of different things behind it. You know, insurance. And when I say conservative Anabaptist, I'm talking Beachy, Mennonite, conservative conference, all the way up to Old Order Amish, Old Order Mennonite. So it's kind of a big umbrella of this. So why is this? And you and I can probably say, oh, well, it's probably because, you know, things are expensive. Oh, people are busy. Oh, they want to do this or that. But I think in the medical community at large, there's not a lot of understanding, and there's not a lot of research done on conservative Anabaptists outside of, like, the big gene testing things, like the maple syrup urine disease. Like, there's a lot of studies on those, or a lot of the genetic issues there's a lot of studies on. But to hear the voices of conservative Anabaptists saying, this is why we're doing what we're doing. And so we can meet those needs better. Okay, so then theories. Theories are created in rigorous structuring of ideas that project a tentative, purposeful, and systematic view of the phenomenon. And so a theory that I'm using in my nursing research is called the theory of cultural marginality, which in this theory, there's a man named Choi, and he developed this theory to help explain people who straddle two distinct cultures. And as conservative Anabaptists, we straddle two distinct cultures, right? We straddle cultures within our own communities. Anytime a group of people get together, there's a culture. There is a culture here tonight, right? Okay, and so this is going to help lay the foundation. And again, when I first started this, like anything that was theory or philosophy, I just would roll my eyes and groan and think, I don't want to study this. What does this have to do? I'm a practical person. I'm a bedside nurse. Like theories and philosophy is over my head. I just want to work. I want to get my patients better. But what we really need to understand is that theories help lay the foundation into why we're doing what we're doing and so forth. Okay, so with that being said, there are a couple of verses that I really wanted to use within my my dissertation or my research that kind of substantiate my reasoning in this. And the first one is 1 John 3:7, and that's if anyone has material possessions and sees a brother or sister in need, but has no pity on them, how can the love of God be in that person? On Sunday, I'm going to talk about caring in the human health experience, and we're going to go a little bit deeper into this. And I think all of us went into healthcare. Later, I'm going to have y'all introduce yourself so we know where you stand and where you belong, because you know, I want to know that. But as far as for me, as far as most of you, there's a reason why you went into healthcare, and it's not because the money's so good, okay? It's not because 12 hours, three 12-hour shifts sounds wonderful, and they're not exhausting at all. You know, things like that. There's something inside you that led you there. And the second verse is Galatians 6:10, which you'll be seeing again on Sunday. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all people, especially to those who belong in the family of believers. And again, a lot of us are taking care of our communities, we're taking care of our families, we're taking care of our community, our family of believers. And how do we do that effectively? And I think a lot of us have a lot of, you know, COVID trauma about trying, you know, relating to our congregations on what's going on with this whole COVID pandemic and the different sides that we see all over the place, and how do we best meet their needs, okay? How do we best educate, advocate, and get information, good information, to our family of believers? And again, this is something that, for me personally, is not required in a PhD dissertation at a big university. I don't know if WVU is that big. It's bigger than some. But something for me, because I'm going into this different than a lot of people. Like, I truly want to have an understanding of that. Okay, so transcending health values. What does that even mean? What does that big 50-cent word, transcending, mean? Basically, transcending is to be able to go beyond the range of limits or surpass a person or achievement. I also have up here that this is a mutual unfolding between one providing care and the one being cared for. You know, I can speak to nursing because I'm a nurse. And we have the medical model, we have the nursing model, and nursing is still trying to get their footing into discipline and trying to get their footing into being their research being taken seriously and important and useful. But as nurses, and a lot of us fall into that category, we still follow the nursing model, but we're still under the medical model, which there's nothing wrong with that. But I think for nursing, that caring really can come through. And so this mutual unfolding that I want to talk about is kind of like, and transcending, going above and beyond. You know, if we get into a group here, we may talk about how I feel of vaccines and how you feel of vaccines, okay? It might be the same, it might be opposite. And I'm not arguing that, and is one way wrong, is one way right? Well, that's your opinion, medical opinion. But the thing is that we need to transcend, and we need to go beyond our beliefs, and our goal is to care for our people, right? Because I was going to use this big word, my wife told me I probably shouldn't, but it's a paradigm called the Unitary Transformative Paradigm. And basically what that means is that our patients and us as healthcare are working together, basically, that we're all energies working together. And so how do we care? How do we care for one another? You know, we have people that come into the wherever you're working, and they have ideas about certain things. So how do we effectively care for them? So growing up in a Christian home, in a Christian household, you know, we will be taking care of transgendered people, if you haven't already. I have. And so what's my feelings about taking care of a transgender person? Do I believe that this is something that should happen? No. But should I care for them as a human being? Absolutely. Jesus died for them just like he died for me. And sometimes I have to remind myself that, especially when patients are being ugly. You know, like, I don't want to go in that room, but you know what? Jesus died for them so I can spend, you know, 15 minutes with them. Okay? So sometimes it doesn't mean compromising your beliefs. Let me get that straight. It doesn't mean compromising your beliefs. However, transcending what some of our values. Okay, so this concept that I developed was using this 10-step process created by Lear and Smith. The funny thing is, Dr. Smith of the Lear and Smith, she helped me do this, which is bizarre. Like, she wrote the book, and she'd be like, Matthew, turn to page so-and-so in my book. And I turned to so-and-so page in her book, and there she would be. And Dr. Mary Jane Smith is a pretty well-known nurse theorist, I've had the pleasure to work with her, and she's been mentoring me. I think she's like 80-some, and she really gets excited over theory, and she's brilliant beyond my understanding, and sometimes she talks, and as she's talking, like, as we do Zoom, like, I'll go to Google and look up words, and so I can sound smart with her, and yeah, so Kevin Koblentz heard me use a word in leadership the other day. He's been picking on me about it, but like my vocabulary is enhancing. Anyway, but let you rest assured, Kevin, sometimes she'll just say, no, 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 Matthew, what are you thinking? I don't know, Dr. Smith, I don't know what I'm thinking. Anyway, so I'm using this process, and I'm showing you this because I want to let you know that there is a process to developing concepts and theories for nursing research, but also one part of this whole thing was a practice story, the very first. So what is the process developing this concept? The main thing starts with a practice story. So most people that do research because there's something that they're interested in. They just don't go to a hat and pick out and say, oh, I chose diabetes today. This is what I will study. If you do that, you're going to be bored out of your mind, right? So typically it comes out of a practice story. So what happened to make you decide to want to do this? So for me, my practice story that made me want to do this was I was taking care of an old order Amish lady in the emergency room where I was at. And I went in to see her because they operate a bulk food store near my house, so I've seen them before. And she has a malformation in her arm, and she gets infected. Anyway. So I walked in the room and I started talking Pennsylvania Dutch to her. And you know what she did? She lit up, right? She lit up and she told me that she was in pain. She told me all of this information. And so I went out to the doctor. I was like, oh, you know, so-and-so and there is this, this, and this is going on. He's like, well, she didn't tell me any of that. You know, why didn't she tell me any of that? It was because, and we're going to go on to see how this develops, but there was this comfort and connectedness. She knew that I kind of understood her. And, you know, and this goes outside of the Amish and Mennonites and things like that. I've had people tell me that I grew up going to church with, like, they would say, like, Matthew, I know you were in the emergency room, but it was just so nice knowing that you were in the hospital, that, you know, I wasn't doing anything with it, but I was at least present in the hospital in case they needed something. So there is this comfort and connectedness. The other thing is that really struck me was that I was noticing a lot in my home church and within some of the people that I was working for, especially the old order, because of the new order church, they have Curtis, who they see Curtis first, and he takes care of their needs. You'll get to hear about that tomorrow. But a lot of times when they come in, you know they're sick. They don't come in because, you know, I had a patient once come in by emergency squad because they needed a bath. Okay? She was drunk, she was going on a date, and she was afraid she was going to drown, so she wanted us to give her a bath. No joke. So they're not coming in for, you know, hangnails. They're not coming in for, and people in our churches are not coming in for piddly stuff. When they come in, we know they're sick, right? It's kind of like when a farmer comes in, you know that they're sick. But why are they waiting so long? Why is there a delay? Okay? And so from this this practice story, we read this thing like 50 times, and we started looking for themes. And one of the things is a delay in health-seeking behaviors is something that I come into contact a lot with. However, there's comfort with connectedness, that people find comfort with people that they connect with. And that doesn't have to mean like, oh, well, they're only going to be comfortable with another Amish person or another Mennonite person or another, you know, even with a Methodist church or a Baptist church, a Baptist person. But a lot of times they're just connected, they're comforted, even if they have a Christian doctor. Because I want a Christian doctor. I want a doctor that's going to take care of me, that has a foundation in Christ, and anyway, and so there's that. So with comfort and connectedness, there can be an ease in cultural tension. Because you heard me talking about people that straddle two distinct cultures. We can ease cultural tension within our own communities and beyond. So that's really where this is going. So how will this build to the body of nursing knowledge? Because that's my goal, because I am a nurse researcher at this point. It's going to build because there's not a lot of information on how conservative Anabaptists describe health-seeking behaviors. Like I said before, I'm going to show you a couple research articles that I have found that I did in my my systematic review that are pretty interesting. But I think I'm the type of nurse that if you say something funny, like, I'm going to chart it. You know, like, if you call me a name, like, I'm going to chart it. Or if you say something, like, that's going to be in my notes. Because I really like that, the subjective data, that subjective information. And it's maybe it's the nurse in me. Because I think it's really telling. Like, it's really telling. And so I like qualitative research. I know there's the quantitative nerds that likes the numbers and the data and the bell-shaped curves and the lines. I'm not one of those people. I like the qualitative, like, how does that make you feel type questions. Anyway, and so you can tell me about that. So that's where it's going to be. And I think that another thing is, I think that it would surprise a lot of people because you have, the crunchy herbs and roots people. You treat them in the hospital. They know stuff, right? They know what's going on. And they know their body, and they've done a lot of research. Now, where they got that research, I don't know, because I've learned that you can find research to prove whatever you think. It just depends on where you're going. Are you going in with an open mind, or are you going in with a narrow? And like I said, these people, you know what? The other day, I had a cold that I couldn't get rid of for a month. Like, I was Googling everything that I could. Like, I even slept with sliced onions on my feet. Okay? Is there any science behind that? I don't know. Was I desperate? Yeah. Right? Ended up, got an antibiotic and worked. So I'm not poo-pooing these people, because I think that there are fantastic things being done with burdock leaves, and I think there's fantastic things being done with supplements. But I'm just saying, my whole thing is there's a gamut, and where are we going? Anyway, so my qualitative research question, which you heard me say before, is how do conservative Anabaptists describe health-seeking behaviors? So what I'm going to do, I'm going to do a focus group. I'm going to do 3 focus groups, and I'm going to get conservative Anabaptists that do not have medical background, because I think that will skew some of the data, to meet in focus groups and ask them specific questions to allow them to talk and discuss. Questions like, so when you get sick, where do you go? You know, do they go to Be Your Own Doctor book, which I bought today? I saw that in Belleville, so I bought it today. Or do they go to WebMD? Because, you know, if you work in healthcare, you know, they come in and say, you know, WebMD says it's cancer. You know, everything ends up in death when you go to WebMD. And where are you getting it? Are you getting it from a blog somewhere? Okay, so where are you getting your healthcare information? And is it legit? Okay? And like I said, I think there are some fantastic herbalists. I will drink an herbal tea. My personal belief is I like to use a mixture of the both. But I also want to know when this side's not working, that it's time for me to go to the other side. Not the other side, other side. So my literature support, there are three studies that I think are fantastic. That were very interesting. One was done in Pennsylvania, the one by Fry. One was done in Canada, the McBride article, and one was done by Kotz from Ohio. We'll talk about the Fry one first. They did a survey of 298 Old Order Amish people. Amish people in 2 different communities in Pennsylvania on immunization, especially of HIB. So let's go there first. So they wanted to identify, these researchers wanted to identify the purpose of the reservoirs of HIB and assess barriers to vaccination among Amish communities in Pennsylvania. And again, it has nothing on how I feel, you feel, we feel about vaccination. This is just an interesting study. It is interesting that the community, the one Amish community that had a midwife that was actively encouraged vaccination, had a higher vaccination level and a higher percentage of parents who planned to vaccinate their children in the future. And I put underneath there champion, because there's a champion within that community. There's somebody educating. There's somebody that they can connect with. There's somebody that can tell them what they need to do. So we know that HIB, or I, maybe we know what HIB is and what it can do to children. Kind of like pertussis is another one that I will find outbreaks of pertussis in Amish and conservative Mennonite circles due to lack of immunization against that. And if you've ever seen a kid with pertussis, you would run and get that vaccine. Right? And so anyway, it's just interesting that due to a connecting champion, you know, it had influence. That's the key, what I wanted to say, that there was influence in someone. This McBride article was developed to deliver and evaluate a cancer screening intervention focused on rural Anabaptist communities in Ontario, Canada, to increase routine cancer screenings among women. Let me go back here. Whoops. They did 75, the number was 75, and they did interventions to women for cancer screening. They talked a lot about what barriers were there in providing health services. Participants needed to be self-paying or register with a family health team providing health services, otherwise they couldn't receive the screening. Health insurance requirements and provider-administered cervical cancer and colon cancer screening requirements appear to be barriers to accessing cancer screening that are not trivial. Walkability and spatial distribution of cancer screening infrastructure was also an issue. So we can see that transportation and insurance was an issue here. And so developing programs like, I know in our area we have something called in West Virginia, we have something called Bonnie Bus, and basically they go to rural health clinics and do mammograms in the parking lot. So how can we do screenings better? How can we get these resources out better? The second one by Katz, the purpose of this study was to conduct face-to-face interviews to document cancer screening rates among Amish and then compare their screening rates to Ohio non-Amish. So this was really this was a really interesting article as well, because they did about the same half and half Amish to non-Amish, you know, whatever you want to call them. And the interesting thing was the non-Amish had a higher cancer risk, I should say risk, higher instances of cancer than the Amish. So think about like why is that? So one of the things was because most of the Amish don't do a lot of screenings, right? We screen everyone for everything, right? So people come in and we're screening that we're doing, Pap tests, we're doing mammograms, we're doing all these different things, PSAs on everyone. Now, and most of the conservative Anabaptists are not doing those routine screenings unless maybe there's a, you know, the day that they're like, everyone come for $59, you can do this health panel. Okay, that's really only time. And those are fantastic because we can find things, right? We can find things there. Anyway, so that was one thing, because they weren't doing screenings. Another thing would maybe be, health, health related, how they eat, how they, do things like that. So, again, very interesting research articles. So how is this applicable to us? Like, why did I decide to talk to you about it? Was it because I've already done a lot of work and I didn't really have to do anything but throw things on a slide? No, not... That wasn't the only reason. But I really wanted to say, because I think in the last 3 years, however long this COVID thing has been going on, like I think that I have experienced, I don't know, like I can't tell you how many phone calls that I've gotten from people in the community asking me, what I thought about this vaccine, or what do I think about this, or what do I think about this theory that's floating around, and things like that, and what is my responsibility to them? Like, I want to care for them. And however, like, you know, what I always tell people, like, you know, this is just my opinion. This is what I would do. However, if you feel different, you can go to the doctor, you know, kind of like when they call into the, you know, the emergency room, they're like, hey, should I be checked out for this? Well, I can't tell you off the phone, so just go and see your doctor. You know, it's kind of like the cop-out. Go see your doctor. So how do I, where am I transcending? How are we caring for those people when they may have different ideas about things than us? You know, especially people that we love, our brothers and sisters within our own communities. How can we do better at educating, but not accusing and not making them feel dumb? Because a lot of times, like when people will look at me and sometimes be suspicious, like, Matthew, why are you going to get your PhD? Like, what is that going to make you a better nurse? No. Like, you know, me and my wife could work in, you know, side by side, and we could do the same job. She has an associate's degree. I'll almost have a PhD. Will it make me a better? So people become very suspicious about why I want to do. And I don't know if maybe you guys have experienced some of that too. Like, why do you want to go in for more education? Like, you know, these liberal universities, and you know, I understand. I'm on some committees at my university that I just don't agree with. But I can put my input there. You know, I've had students that have grown up in conservative Anabaptist communities that I have taught. And their parents will say, you know, we feel so much better knowing that you are there teaching them. And so there's things like that. So how can we educate without being overbearing? How can we get good information out there? And that's it. Good information to our community, our churches, well, even our patients, you know, outside of that. How are we going to be able to transcend when you have somebody coming in saying that they are a female and they obviously look like a man with a 5 o'clock shadow? You know, how are we going to take care of them? And what is the process there? So this is the conclusion of what I have to share. I just wanted to open it up for questions if you had any questions for me. It could be about this. It could be about maybe you something I said or something that I talked about you don't agree with. I offer, you know, criticism too. I shouldn't say, just be nice. You know, you can evaluate me later, right? I said my students evaluate me. But yeah, is there any questions?